We can't. So I'm going to give an introduction. I'm going to summarize some key points. I did watch the video with Oprah, the interview, to kind of get a, you know, what that was. And then I read my chapter like a good student. So I'll kind of just go through and do some highlights of what I think are the key points. Richard Rohr packs things. I mean, I have so many underlines in every page, and I go back and try to get the highlights, and sometimes it feels quite dense. You know, I mean, a lot of deep thought. But some personal notes, some kind of reactions to it. And then I want to take this theme of being in Christ and love and look at it in different ways. Some architecture that I saw in Vienna, a print by Rembrandt, a movie that came out recently, and a place in town. Think about La Casa a little bit. And then if we have time at the end, a little reading from Grapes of Wrath. So each of those things spoke to me today of the theme. So the idea is we kind of get based in what Rohr is saying and then kind of venture out. And I hope by doing that, it'll activate your own insight and own thoughts on things. So before I start the actual program, as I think you know, John Dominic Crossan's coming to town. And Tom, I saw Tom did come. Tom Weissenberger, who is an elder at St. Andrews, he's coordinating this. He's been the guy behind it all. And is there anything you'd want to say, Tom? Or you're all welcome. Brian McLaren's there all late Saturday, so that was something we neither community knew. So this may be Mr. Crossan's last trip through, yeah.
If you is that good? If you want to come Friday night, that's perfectly fine. We would the whole session is $25, but Friday night, if you could chip in 10, that's a suggested donation for that. And you know, bring your friends because he's an amazing speaker. He's a really nice guy, too. There'll be books for sale that he loves to sign, too, if you want to. So, come on.
Next weekend. The 21st.
The week from tomorrow night, yeah.
21st and 22nd. And he has a delightful Irish accent.
St. Andrew's Presbyterian Church, which is out by San Marcos High School. There's flyers are out there. Yeah. He's also, since St. Andrew's had him coming, then he's going to be speaking at UCSB. He's also speaking at Westmont next Thursday, a week from today at 4 in the afternoon, on Jesus and Roman Imperial Theology. So it's a free lecture. I think it's at the Global Leadership Center at Westmont. So there's different chances you could see him. I'm also still somewhat involved at Hospice of Santa Barbara and have helped them coordinate a series they're doing, a Learn at Lunch on Fridays, on looking at death and dying in different religious perspectives. So that's on the third Friday of the month. This next Friday will be Art Cisneros from the Chumash community talking about Native practices and traditions and understandings. Then the month after that is Elizabeth Molitor, who I think was just here last week, from Trinity Episcopal. The next month will be Sister Brasha Prana from the Vedanta Society, talking about the Hindu perspective. Who's, and those of you know who Brasha Prana, she's just a delight. Mark Childs, the cantor from Congregation B'nai B'rith on Jewish practices. So third Friday of the month, noon, it's free. Supposed to call ahead just so they know you're coming. But it's the first one we had was Mukhtar Khan from the Islamic Society, and it was just terrific. So anyway, that's happening. And then I'm involved in another project, as is Alice McDonald, called the Human Family Project. And this is started at Congregation B'nai B'rith, a Jewish temple in town, particularly after the Pittsburgh shooting and the Poway shooting. After the Pittsburgh shooting, they had a vigil and 1,000 people showed up. And they were so, B'nai B'rith was deeply moved and grateful for all that. And Steve he's just such an amazingly insightful guy. And he said, you know, we're just constantly in this reactive mode of some tragedy happens and we react and get together. But let's create some long-term, constructive, engaged, community-based thing where we're engaging with each other from different faith traditions in the schools, service clubs, all that kind of stuff. So it's a big project. UCSB is cooperating. And if you want more information about that, I have some flyers. And you can sign up, like St. Andrews did, to sign up to be one of the official communities. Word and Life could do that if that's something you want. And I know Alice has been involved in that. So those are just kind of the local, it's like the local community calendar. But if you have any questions about any of those things, let me know. Okay, so Love is the Meaning, Richard Rohr. The first thing he says that I'll always remember this from his book if I forget everything else, and I think that's true for lots of us. I dedicate this book to my beloved 15-year-old black lab, Venus, whom I had to release to God while beginning to write this book. Without any apology, lightweight theology, or fear of heresy, I can appropriately say that Venus was also Christ for me. And that was, I mean, that's an amazing statement. And in so many traditional theological trainings, that is heresy. That is lightweight theology. But it's wonderful at this point that Rohr, and I think a lot of us, have gotten to a much more wide, deep, mystic-based sense of the wonder of life, and that it's not just rational human beings that have the concern of the divine, but all of life, and we're just a part of that. And so that theme of the dog is, I'm going to kind of have the dog follow us through today, because I think that's a wonderful touchstone for us to keep thinking about. How have we been taught to think about God's presence in the world and what it means to be in Christ, and what may be possible beyond what we've been thinking. Okay, so some key themes. This was things that I picked up in the interview with Oprah. I'm sure all of you have probably seen that. And sorry again for the small print. Must feel like, oh, I hate going to the DMV when they ask me to read the eye chart. But so, key point. Jesus became the universal Christ, but we made him a tribal God. Very basic point. And that could be true for any of the cultures that have appropriated and institutionalized who Jesus is. It's a wonderful thing to be humble about our knowledge of God. I remember years ago in seminary studying Kierkegaard, and he used to say, whenever you talk about God, you should always turn up the corner of your mouth just a little bit and smile, because it's kind of preposterous that we can really think we can understand it all. So just kind of smile a little bit whenever we're, you know, we want to be humble. We want to be very respectful of what's beyond us. Rohr said, when Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life, that's the logos, the Christ speaking, the universal presence of God, not the historical Jesus. The way reaches across human culture and time. There's no reason for anybody to be excluded. Again, that's a pretty bold statement in the last 2,000 years of theology. Jacob anointing the rock at Bethel is the beginning of the Christ tradition. Now, I'm going to come back to this. I'm going to challenge that a little bit. But that's one thing he said. The first time Jacob wakes up, and he's had this dream of the stairway to heaven, he anoints that rock, and Rohr says that's the beginning of this Christ tradition, that there's something sacred even in that prosaic stone that Jacob just happened to find in the wilderness. Okay, so I want to ask you, what was the first thing that or creature that you loved as a child? Rohr in his book talks about different things we can love. And for me, it was easy. It was a dog. It wasn't named Venus. It was named Rusty. And Rusty was a German Shepherd Collie mix. So when we take Rusty out, everybody in those days was watching Lassie on TV. So little kids would go, Lassie, Lassie. But I had Rusty from the time I was 6 months old till I went to college for 17 years. And when my parents were being terribly unfair to me, I could hold on to Rusty and tell him all about it. As my sister and I would run around the neighborhood, he'd follow us and kind of always be keeping an eye on us. And that sense of the purity of that love, I certainly experienced in Rusty. So think for a second. What was either a person or an animal or an activity that you just had a pure love for when you were young, looking back? Anybody want to just mention something? A dog? Another dog? Yeah, Jackie. A rock. Really, a rock? Well, a great big rock. Wonderful. So a big rock really had presence for you. It had, Spot. Same kind of thing, just this continuous. Yes. Water. Anything to do with water just felt like a pure divine blessing. Just a, yeah. Anybody else? A grandfather. And did you see him often or just occasionally or every morning? Wow. What a beautiful thing. Yeah. So I think, yes, go ahead. Large fir trees. Specifically, fir trees had some connection. Climb way up high in a fir tree and feel close to God. So I think these are all things Rohr would applaud. And sometimes bad theology over the years has said, well, we shouldn't, you know, that's paganism or something. But as Rohr talks about, no. Creation is imbued with blessing, with tov, goodness. And the presence there is what we can build on as we go on into deeper things. Okay, key themes, continuing with Oprah. A great statement of his, God loves things by becoming them. Pretty fascinating thing to think about. God doesn't isn't standoffish, but engaged and comes into matter. Good religion is both personal and cosmic. There's something about good religion. I mean, my ideal thing, if I go to a worship service, I want to feel like it's speaking to me personally in my life, but also calling me to something beyond me and help me understand this complex experience we're having of life. We should stop using the word God for 50 years, quoting Karl Rahner, that word gets so heavily used and misunderstood. I know years ago I heard that there was a great chaplain back east, and students used to come to him and say, you know, I don't think I believe in God. And he would say, well, let's sit down and tell me about the God you don't believe in, because I probably don't believe in that God either. Because over time we accumulate, sometimes from childhood or what other people have told us, what God is about. And one of the delights of adulthood is unlearning some of that. And learning that there's something much more evocative and mysterious, as Rohr talks about. Love, like water, flows downward. It always seeks the lower place. And I can't help but think about that in terms of my hospice experience in the midst of suffering, mortality, sometimes messy rooms. When love's there, it just can be right there in the middle, absorbing all of that, just flowing down to whatever's happening in that moment, and it's all sacred. The inherent dignity in creation and human beings is there from the beginning. Somebody doesn't have to be saved to have inherent dignity. It's the imago Dei, it's the image of God. It's something that's implanted in us before we're even aware of it. So, then going to the chapter now. Love is the meaning, and we've got, I don't know if you can see, but that is the dog there. That's the dog. He's going to follow us. He says, Teilhard said that love is the very physical structure of the universe. I know a lot of you know Teilhard de Chardin, and Rohr really resonates with that, that there's gravity, there's those physical forces, love is the core of that. And I think about the comment about this large stone. A lot of you probably know the story that Teilhard, when he was a young boy, he would sit by a lake. He was in Switzerland or France, I think. And the water would just lap up and the stones would be kind of rolling over and back. And he felt those stones were alive. And he became a paleontologist and everything else that he did was built out of that sense that these stones have life in them. They're not inert matter. To be in love is to move out of ourselves, which threatens the ego. So to be in love means we're going out, and that makes us vulnerable. Love is a paradox. We have to decide to let it flow, but we share it without expectation of payment. We just make a decision to love a person, a place, a cause, And when we're in that journey, we open up. There's a sense in which just being in that relationship is the power, not necessarily what's the takeaway, what's the payoff, you know. Love allows and accommodates everything in human experience, both the good and the bad, and nothing else can really do that. And I think of grace. What does grace turn away? Nothing. The most complicated, difficult lives we've had, in the presence of grace, it's all just absorbed like water into the earth. Okay, religion is more about waking up than cleaning up. It's kind of a great statement, and you know that a lot of traditional religion is we're terrible, we're stained from the beginning. The whole life is constantly cleaning up all the time. This last year at St. Andrews, I was preaching through Exodus and some other things, and really got interested in the Puritans, and I was reading back on a lot of the Puritan ways of seeing things, which was pervaded with a sense of the glory of creation, but also with the pervasive sense of things, of human beings being unclean and unworthy. But for Rohr, that's after a point, that there's a lot more to it. It's about waking up, seeing who we are, seeing where we are in our world, in our universe, not just cleaning up. Obedience is about cleaning up. Love is about waking up. So same kind of thing. To be obedient, to say you have to do this, that's kind of like a command from down, top down, to clean things up, get things right, and so you'll be acceptable. But again, he's taking a different tack, that it's great religion is about waking up. I think about, I'm sure a lot of you know Barbara Brown Taylor, who was the writer, Episcopal priest back east, and I remember her book, Leaving Church. I remember reading that, I kind of almost felt forbidden because I was thinking about leaving the church. But she said that one thing that was hard for her as a pastor is she felt so much pressure to always help people believe what they thought they were supposed to believe, when she just wanted to behold. Just to behold. And to her, calling into the ministry and into the life of faith was about beholding these mysteries and these wonders and these truths. But she felt such pressure by some parishioners. Tell me why I should believe this, because I know I'm supposed to believe it. And Barbara Brown herself may not have believed that, but she felt that burden. Christ uses our mistakes for transformative purposes. I think that's fundamental gospel stuff. I used to say, imagine being in two congregations you're going to choose to go to on a Sunday morning. And in one of them, everybody is working really hard to make sure that everybody else thinks that they've had no difficulty or failure in life. And the other one is everybody knows everybody else has had difficulty and failure and disappointment and has accepted that this is life. So you go into the first place, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work to be constantly, as a congregation or as an individual, putting on this sense of I haven't messed up too bad. But the places of grace are the places, after I was in the ministry for a while, people would say, who are your favorite theologians? And I would say the older people in my congregations that have lived through a lot and lived day to day with humility, love, engagement. And they know something I want to know by the time I'm out of here. It's not a conceptual thing, it's a lived thing. So I think Christ uses our mistakes for transformative purposes, and our disappointments, our heartbreaks. The longer we live, the more we can accumulate of those. He did say, I'm a little uncomfortable with this, but he said, it's no wonder fellow Jews had to kill Jesus, just as many Catholics would love to eliminate Pope Francis. So, you know, I understand his point, but I think especially in the last few years with the hate crimes, and we had Rabbi Cohen come out to St. Andrews and talk about anti-Semitism and the history of it and what it feels like. Anytime these days I hear something about the Jews killing Jesus, it just really activates me. And I'll say a little bit more about Rohr comments on those kind of things in a bit. But that was a comment of his, and what he meant was, is that as Francis is very broad and embracing, in not every way, but many ways, there are a lot of people who think that's wrong, that you're cheapening the gospel. Okay, let's keep going. Most humans need a love object. It becomes our North Star. If we don't find it in love, we'll find it in hate. So we've got to find something to love. And if we aren't finding it, Rohr claims, it can turn into a dark thing. We can feel we're never going to connect, we're angry, and that converts into a darkness. We have within us a God instinct, the need to adore. Kind of getting back to Barbara Brown Taylor's, I just want to behold. I mean, and those moments of adoration are moments in which, it's fascinating for the ego, because in moments of adoration, we see something much greater than us. And sometimes in our natural state, we get threatened by something greater than us. But if it's something extraordinary and beautiful and divine, our ego feels very small, but our soul feels big and wonderful. So this sense of finding something to adore, which could be a rock, a pet, a grandchild, art, service of all kinds. We begin with random things to love. Golf, a clean house, your cat, Steph, your cat. God can use anything to get you started. God is not in competition with reality, but in full cooperation with it. I thought about that, and I think I know what he's saying. I've been playing golf the last couple of years. I don't think it's a total love thing. It's as much confrontation with the lower self as times of adoration. Because it's a complicated activity, but it's an alluring activity, and so I try to keep it at a safe distance. I try to learn from golf, but you can really get to where you're going to master this thing by the time you're gone, and that means you usually die on the golf course still trying. Let's see. In the healings, it's not Jesus' magic power, but a partnered two-step in which we participate physically and spiritually. So he kind of makes this point that sometimes we have this idea that Jesus, kind of a magician, goes around and just passes the magic healing to people. But, and we'll see this a little bit when we get to the Rembrandt. That's just not the gospel. The gospel, each individual encounter with Jesus is very specific. And it's really based on what's going on that person's life. It could be a physical ailment. It could be psychological. It could be spiritual. Could be social. He doesn't have a template that he just tells everybody the same thing. He has this ability to look into people and know exactly what topic they need to have addressed. Like I said, it could be physical, emotional, spiritual. And for Rohr, he said that there's a sense of it's a cooperative thing. It's not just a passive. Jesus gives people the power to trust their own inner Christ. The eternal Christ is a symbolic superconductor of the divine energies into the world. So, Rohr says that each of us has within us the inner Christ, kind of a latent presence there. And insofar as we engage in our faith and our practices and beholding, that wakes up and comes alive. And that connects with this energy that is beyond ourself. Teilhard, God does not offer himself, and these are all male language, God does not offer himself to our finite beings as a thing all complete and ready to be embraced. It is eternal discovery and eternal growth. The more we think we understand him, the more he reveals himself as otherwise, he withdraws into the depths of himself. And I know when I was starting out, just after I came into Christian faith, it felt like everything I prayed for happened. I was like, this is cool. And I remember I was painting, working for the church we were involved in. I was painting a classroom, and I remember stopping, and my wife, we needed a job. She needed to find a job, and I stopped in the middle of my painting and prayed, and then about 2 minutes later, one of the staff people came over and said, hey, we're going to ask, would your wife be interested in working in the preschool? And I thought, this works great. This is like, so you kind of think, I mean, in my innocence, I thought, this is like, great. But then you go on in life, and some things come. And some things never do. And you're like, what happened there? And I think, and sometimes very long periods in our life where we yearn and we pray and nothing happens. And then other times we yearn and pray and something happens. So for Rohr, it's not just a static relationship. It's very much a symbiotic kind of a thing. And God can seem to withdraw. There's times when we withdraw from God. But that's never the end of the relationship. Okay, getting there. Either God or I can create the pullback. There's this experience, of course, of the divine Deus abscondus, the divine hiding the face, which I've kind of mentioned. Yet God always takes the lead in the dance, which we only recognize over time. And I think that's really true. I certainly can think of times in my life I look back and I think God isn't with me at all. Years later I look back and go, oh, just not where I was looking. Somewhere else, there was something going on that led me eventually to knowing what was happening, but at the time I didn't see it. The only thing that separates you from God is the thought that you are separate from God. So we can't change the reality of us being connected to God. That's non-negotiable. The error is when we think we're separate. That's the glitch. Okay, so I'll stop there. I'm going to make some comments. But any comments about, I went through a lot of concepts in small print on a screen far away. So any comments on any of those points? Or yeah, if anybody wants to. Yes.
About golf, which I thought, it seems so much like the spiritual way, which is that it's simple, but it's really not easy at all.
Yeah, golf's pretty amazing because you could be a total amateur and you could go out and hit a 50-yard shot without knowing what you're doing and sink it. And you could have 100 pros with the same shot and they can't sink it. So you think, I'm special. And then you keep going and then it's just a cycle of hope and despair. So that's why it's a wonderful spiritual discipline. It's quite potent. Okay, so having kind of laid Rohr out there, just kind of stepping back as I was reading it, some things that occurred to me. This is the Torah, the Jewish scripture over here. Father Vincent was an amazing man. Father Vincent Martin, I don't know if any of you might remember him from a long time ago. He was a monk at St. Andrew's Priory, the Benedictine monastery out in Pear Blossom, out near Lancaster. And in the early 80s, I'd never been to a monastery. I was trying to learn about Catholic contemplative practices. I called and said, can I come and stay there? And they said, well, we're having an investiture of a novice that night. We'll be kind of busy, but you're welcome. So I came, and I was there for the ceremony. Didn't understand much, but that's okay. And I went into the dining room out there, and having maybe just on cartoons or other things, what do monks eat? I thought, probably gruel. And water. So I walk in to this dining room, and there's like prime rib and turkey, Dos Equis beer, wine, cigars, all this stuff. And I'm like, wow, I didn't think this would be the monastery. And he goes, well, one of the brothers used to be a chef at the Hyatt Regency. So when we have an important thing, you know, we have a good time. And I'm like, man, this is great. So I went, and there was an old monk sitting at one of the tables, and I kind of sat across from him. And I introduced myself, and he said he was Father Vincent Martin. And I said, well, tell me a little about your background. And he said that he had been raised in Belgium and then spent 20 years in China, 30s and 40s. And then in the 50s, after they were evicted from China, he came and found a monastery out there. And I said, oh, so, and he told me once that he would think in French, speak English, but dream in Chinese. After all those years, and he loved all those cultures. So when I was having that first dinner with him, I said, wait a minute, you were in China in the 30s and 40s. That's when Teilhard was there. And he said, I used to talk with Teilhard every Tuesday afternoon. And I was like, wow. And I said, so what'd you think? He goes, brilliant man, but he did not understand the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Which I think what Father Vincent was saying is that we can tend, and I'll kind of keep on this theme, in the West particularly, we can make everything very clean and orderly and put things into systems. But the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of the Torah, is kind of an unpredictable sometimes and disruptive God. So I always try to remember that. I also, similarly, when I was going off to seminary, there was a Presbyterian pastor in San Diego who had been raised Jewish. and before he became Christian and a pastor. And he said, oh, you're going off to seminary. Well, you've got to study with me. I've got to tutor you. Because they're going to try to turn you into a Greek. And if you're a Greek, everything's supposed to make sense and everything is very logical. But I'm going to teach you how to be a Jew. I'm going to teach you that it's important to be mad. You kind of talk about it. You have an open heart. You don't try to fit everything together. It's like, oh, okay. So for that summer, Michael tutored me in trying to learn how to be a good Hebrew, as well as a pastor. Going back there, Abraham Joshua Heschel, some of you may remember that name, amazing man. He once said, God is not a kind uncle. God is an earthquake. God is an earthquake. So I think there's times in which it feels like God is a wonderfully caring uncle. But I keep remembering that don't make it too domesticated. Let the divine have some freedom to be an earthquake. And I just a little hesitation with Richard Rohr, that he claims in dialogue with other faiths. I saw him at Santa Fe a few years ago, speaking at the International Spiritual Directors Conference. And the Spiritual Directors group nationally was really been really wanting to cultivate a Jewish presence as well as generally Christian. And Rohr was one of the speakers, and there was some Jewish folks on the tables next to me. And Rohr was saying at one point, I don't remember exactly what he was saying, but he said, but you know, we have the trump card. Forget the word Trump, but you know what I mean. We have the trump card because we have the incarnation. And I thought, and I looked over and the Jewish folks were kind of going, it's basically like, you know, we want you here, but we've got the superior truth. And he may not have meant it that way, but I picked up a little bit of that. And just when he says that when Jacob anointed the stone, that's the beginning of the Christ. I hear the bell. My Jewish friends would say, we would never describe it that way. It wouldn't say, on that stone, that's where Christ began. So I think Rohr is looking at it with the lens of his own theological perspective, which is why we're listening to him. But I kind of always get a little, just want to put a little footnote. And let's see, time-wise, are we ready for the break? Was it? No, okay, I heard a bell. So I didn't. By the way, you might have seen a New Yorker cartoon where there are a couple of dogs in a lab and then behind a window is a researcher in a white coat and the one dog says to the other, you know, what's really great is that if when he rings the bell and you salivate, he gets really excited. So, anyway, I heard the bell and I got excited, so. All right. Okay. Associations. Father Virgil on being saved. I know this group started with Father Virgil. What a privilege for any of us that knew him. I was privileged to sit with him on the boards at hospice and at La Casa. And every time we'd be there, I'd try to sit next to him and say, so what are you thinking about these days, Father Virgil? And he was amazing. And one time he said, and this is not long before he died, he said, you know what I've been thinking about? I've been thinking that Jesus wants everybody saved, but doesn't care whether it's through him or not. Jesus wants everybody to be saved, but he doesn't really care whether it's through him or not. And he smiled. You know, Father Vincent always had a big smile. And I think that that's kind of where Rohr's going. And when we look at the Gospels, I think in the interactions with individual people before the doctrines get established, in individual interactions, Jesus is asking people very little things about what they're supposed to believe in order to receive grace. He interacts with people, the grace comes. If you want to follow and understand more, then that follows. But there's not this transaction. And I think that's made me think of Father Virgil. I remember he also said, somebody in the Vatican had written him or something and said, you know, when you get to heaven and see God, the thing that's going to overwhelm you is God's humility. When you get to heaven and see God, the thing that's going to overwhelm you is God's humility. Because we often paint it in huge, glorious things. But, and I'm not sure exactly what he meant by that, but anything Father Virgil said, I tried to keep. Okay, Ram Dass, who died, a great, interesting, fascinating figure from the 60s, and Zen hospice training. When I was at hospice, some of us went up for a week up at the Zen Hospice Center up in Marin County, and a lot of it was sitting meditation, which I know a lot of you have done in different traditions. And one thing that happens is that you get an itch. You're sitting there and your cheek starts itching, and that becomes kind of like golf. It becomes the thing that you have to prove yourself. So the question always becomes, what do you do? Do you itch it? Which is, can be encouraging our tendency to always keep reacting to things immediately. Or do you try to just let it pass? And that cheek is itching and you want to itch it. But you're learning how to let these impulses pass through you and not get attached to them all the time. And after the first few days, I was really enjoying this great meditation teacher. And he was even talking eventually about pain. But he said, one thing you can do, let's say an itch, is you can actually bring your attention to it. We kind of want to turn away from it, but you can bring your attention to it, and sometimes you just let your attention go to that disturbance, and somehow it'll kind of dissolve after a while. And by the last day, he was saying, you can actually bring love to those disturbances and those pains, to cultivate a presence and a quiet of mind, and something's happening with you physically, or a memory, or something, you can actually summon love as like a tangible energy that can address that disturbance. And I experienced that to some degree, and I was like, that's fascinating, quite wonderful. And Ram Dass, he was Skyped in from Hawaii, because since his stroke, that's where he'd been. And I'd seen him speak, I think, at the Arlington years ago. Wasn't really that impressed, but, you know, he was a cultural figure. But he was talking to a group about 30 through the Skype on the television. And at one point he was kind of talking, and then suddenly he got a very serious look. And he looked through the television and he said, you are not a collection of thoughts. You are loving awareness. And I felt through the television, I felt like, that was not just a comment. And I thought about that a lot. Who are we? Often we think of ourselves, a collection of memories, thoughts, blah, blah. He says, what we really are is we're loving awareness. Which I think for Rohr really makes sense. That that's where he's kind of going. That's our true nature. That's the Christ in us, the love in us. Okay, almost done. The challenge of embodying divine love in creation. I read it and I think about love and I'm feeling all connected. And then I think about we've got rats at our house. And I got to do something about the rat. And just loving it isn't going to solve it. I remember at La Casa, Steph and I were interviewing folks for a position which included some, you know, stewardship for the grounds. We had a terrible problem with squirrels and gophers. But we also were compassionate. And spiritual and creation-based. And so one question I would ask, if we have to exterminate some squirrels or gophers, can you do that? And some people thought about it and they thought, no, I can't. So even though I understood the feeling, I thought, we've got 26 acres we've got to care for here. And so there's the complexity on the other side of the simplicity, you know, that the love feeling, which is divine. In real life, it gets complicated, which doesn't mean we abandon it. It means we engage it. Challenge of embodying love in the workplace. I know from being a pastor to an administrator, first at hospice and then at La Casa, I remember Stephanie and I were talking. I said, you know, I know Jesus said you got to forgive people 70 times 7, but how many late times showing up to a shift do you give somebody 490 chances? If that's having a detrimental effect on the team, you know, there's some, it feels like can feel like emotionally an unloving thing sometimes that we have to do. But if we're in charge of things, whether it's grounds or people, at times we have to make difficult things, and love can be there, just not as simplistic as we might have thought at first, I think. Okay, I'll finish with this. Challenges. I put Venus, his dog, Rusty, my dog. But I remember we had a dog when my daughter was young called Olivia, and she couldn't keep from snapping and biting kids. So I had to have her put down. So I felt deep connection with Rusty, as Roar does with Venus. But I'm sorry, but I couldn't let that dog injure children. So again, there's that connection, there's that love, but there's some complexity. Let's see. Marriage. How about marriage? I remember after 15, 20 years married and doing weddings, people would come and talk about they want to get married and they're so in love and it's all going to be wonderful. And I remember thinking, when can we talk about suffering? Because there is a sense in a long relationship where you're dying, your sense of self. And it can be a beautiful path. But love isn't just a sentimental feeling. It involves a lot of depth and work. Okay, so let's take the break here. We're going to go from here into some art and flesh it out.